Good morning.
Well, good morning, Faye. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's Saturday, didn't you know?
You know, every time when you point out that it's Saturday, it makes me think, you know, this is the one day where people can sleep in if they want to. They can get up early if they want to. But even if they get up early, you know, it's like when you get up on Saturday early, it's different than getting up Monday through Friday early because you're kind of on your own timetable. So even if you get up early, it's not like you have to rush around and deal with traffic and whatever else. It's still kind of relaxed and kind of take it easy.
You could stay in your pajamas till noon. Didn't you know that?
Those are the rules for Saturday.
That's right. You can do anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing to me what Saturday's like. It seems like the sun comes up a little brighter. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little warmer. It's a little nicer. I think it's because I'm thinking about all the things I'm going to go do. And everybody always says, Faye, what are you going to do today? And I always, you know, say, well, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to go do that. You know, I think Saturday's just for fun.
I think you're right. You know, I think when you put it in that perspective, I think you're absolutely right. Saturday is for fun.
That's right. You should eat out on Saturday, and you should shop on Saturday.
That's a good idea. Yes.
Oh, shopping is a good thing. You know what it does? It takes the stress out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And women should all tell their husbands that. You know, I'm really stressed today. I need to go shopping. And that is as their husbands go off to the golf course.
Yeah, exactly. So everybody goes and does their own thing, and everybody's happy. You may spend a
That's
lot of
right.
money, but you're happy.
That's right, you're happy. And, you know, men go to the golf course, and, you know, it's supposed to be 4.5 hours.
No.
But then they say, let's do it again, one more nine. And they'll do an extra nine.
Yeah.
I mean, just because we're having so darn much fun.
Well, we need to have more fun. We work all the time, and we're stressed all the time. You hear all these studies about how, you know, people don't take vacation because they're stressed out and they're afraid that they're going to come back. They won't have a job. And it's important to take time for ourselves and do our own thing.
That's right. And it will bring your stress down. You'll live longer. And if not longer, it'll seem like it's longer.
Yes, yes.
And then the other thing is a lot of people go get their grandchildren on Saturday.
Mm.
And that is a fun deal. Of course, mine live with me. And that's a fun deal. You know, when a 3 or 4 year old comes in and says, get up, Mimi. I mean, you wake your eyes up and it's time.
Like, oh, Lord, I got 4 hours to sleep. Let me do more.
That's right. And then, you know, you play with them, you have fun with them. And people need to always remember, these little kids are just going to be little one time. So
that's
we
true.
Better really enjoy them because, you know, when they get big, they don't need us.
No, that is true.
No, they just need us when they're little children.
Yeah.
Oh, my
gosh. It's a special time in kids' lives.
It is, and we should be glad that we're a part of that,
yeah.
And I always am. Well, now, I read something this week, and I want to tell you how wrong we can be about things. You know, we think we know what we're reading, and did you know lots of times you don't know what you're reading?
How do you mean?
Okay, I saw this article about freezing eggs. Well, it got my attention. I said, I didn't know you could freeze an egg. I'd never heard of it being successful. And it said something to the effect about freezing these eggs and how it was done. I said, man, I need to read up on that. I got over there and I was reading. And do you know what it was?
What?
It was embryo eggs. Can you imagine? I thought I knew all about eggs, but I don't know anything about eggs.
I'm like you. My mind was going to like scrambled eggs and fried eggs, over easy eggs.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about all this, and I got to the bottom of that article that said that, and I started laughing. I go, I swear, you just never know what you're reading anymore. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, that's great. This is Your Money with Faye Bagby. Your phone number is?
The phone number is 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. And we're at 3105 Big Spring, right next to Ivy Cottage. And what is our website?
It is AmericanFinancialMidland.com. A ton of information is out there, so people can get a little bit of information before they come talk to you. Maybe they want to see about case studies from past investments, see what investors have made, read some testimonials, kind of find out about the process, find out about the investment, so that they can come in and ask some great questions, which is what a lot of people do. What would you say is probably the number one question when people see you for the first time that they ask?
Well, I think the first question is, how soon can I get invested? How many policies can I get in? That's really important to them, how many policies they can get. How long is this going to take? And how often will they make money? You know, how long are the LEs? Mm-hmm. And then we tell them, you know, they're 24, 30, 12, 18 months, you know, all over the place. And that's according to what kind of cancer they've got as how long it's going to take, you know, for their investment to mature. And so that's the sort of questions I always ask.
Do people understand that they're investing in a life insurance policy when they come in, or is that something that they ask about?
No, most of them say they have a general idea, but they don't know exactly how it works. They have a general idea because they've listened to me on the radio, most of them. If they haven't, a friend has told them about it. And as you know, lots of people tell their friends about us, and then they come in. And the friend will give them a general idea. You know, I've invested in some life insurance policies, and the people have cancer. Mm-hmm. So they tell them that. But they don't know how to tell them how this is going to work. They don't know how to say, okay, you know, Faye bids on these policies. When she gets one, she'll send you an email and say, okay, we've got a $1 million policy here. We'd like you to put $90,000 in. They don't understand that until they talk to me. And then when I explain it all, you know, then they really understand it. Or the husband comes in, I tell him about it. He goes home and tells the wife, and then she says, I think I need to meet with Faye. I mean, because the husband doesn't always tell him exactly how it works.
He kind of gets
so then
it
the
close,
two,
but
the two of them come back.
He leaves a lot of details out, I'm sure, that are important.
He does. He leaves out some of the important aspects of this. You know, it's a good investment, he tells his wife. It's a life insurance policies, but he doesn't know the finer details how to explain it. Mm-hmm. And then when they come back, I go through everything from the moment we start it till they get in the policy and they get their money when it matures.
So when they know that it's a life insurance policy and that you bid it, and, you know, a friend or a family member or whatever the case is, they tell somebody about it, and they come in and they're like, okay, Faye, I know it's a life insurance policy, so I guess maybe start at the beginning. How do you end up with life insurance policies, and how does that become an investment for people?
Well, people who have stage 4 cancer, they go to their insurance broker in the town where they live. And they say, you know, I really need to sell my policy. My cancer is so expensive, I need extra money. So then the broker gets in touch with the licensed providers. Most people in the business, if they're in this business, they know who the licensed providers are. And we use the biggest ones there are. There's no one any bigger than the providers we use. So these people come to them, and then they send me an email. In fact, I had a lot of emails this week about different policies saying, Faye, would you look at this? Would you be interested in this? Does this meet your criteria? So they wanted to see, you know, if the people are sick enough that I'm interested in buying it, am I interested in bidding on it? So if I bid it, how long is it going to take? Well, we may bid something today, but we may not know when bidding stops. It may be 2 weeks before the bidding stops.
So what kind of a policy makes a good policy to bid on? Because I'm sure you get a lot of duds, so to speak. So you're looking at these saying this is not going to be profitable. What kind of things make a policy good?
Well, when they've tried everything there is, you know, when they say, okay, we've been to, you know, this oncologist, we've been to the other oncologist for the second opinion, and we've been on radiation. And they tell all the different chemo, what types of chemo. Sometimes they're on different types of chemo, not just one. And then they talk about radiation. If they're on radiation and they're on chemo, you know that it's very last stages. Because usually they'll do one or the other. They'll either do chemo or they'll do radiation. And then it'll tell us how long they've had it. Maybe it started in 17, and they thought they had it. They operated, and, of course, then it came back. So if it's come back, I'm especially interested in it because that's usually your very final stages. And then there's some cancer that the first stage is bad. If it's pancreatic cancer, you know, you can be dead in 3 or 4 months. Usually we say 9 to 12, but I've had some cases lately that people absolutely did not know they had it. And by the time they found it, they didn't live but another month.
Wow.
Yeah. So pancreatic cancer is, in most cases, is very deadly. So and we bid on so many different kinds. As I said, this year we've done some tongue and some throat cancer, and it is deadly. I don't think the medications don't work as well on that, I don't believe, because these people, we've already gotten everybody's money on it. I mean, it was that quick. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like those are deadlier than some of the others. So we're looking to see if it says it's progressing, you know, and how many new lesions or new tumors that they have. Mm. And then if they're obese, that's another thing I look for. Because people who are obese, it just, they don't do very well.
And I ask all this because this is all very important as far as making an investment a profitable investment. You know, these are all very important details. You don't just get a policy that at the top says, okay, this is breast cancer, bid on it, and you say, okay, yes or no. You're really drilling down, really getting a lot of granular information from these policies, from the policyholder. Like you said, the things that they've tried already, the kinds of treatment that they've had, the kinds of treatment maybe that they haven't had. You're looking at, like you just said, you know, are they obese? Because you know that, you know, that means that it's probably going to be a shorter policy than somebody who may be physically fit and active. And so you're looking at all these things. It's not just a matter of here's what the type of cancer it is, bid yes or no. And I think that really goes to one of these things that really gives people that assurance that, hey, this is a well thought out investment. This is not just a willy-nilly kind of thing. You're looking at other things as well, like maybe things that they haven't done, treatments that they've maybe bypassed, right?
That's right. And then I look to see if they've been in clinical trials. Clinical trials will usually delay your death another 12 months if you're in clinical trials. It gives you a little bit of boost. It isn't going to cure it, but it will. It seems like it does help. If they're in clinical trials, it seems to go a little farther.
And so you might be inclined to maybe skip over.
Yeah, unless they've already finished clinical trials, and lots of times they go to clinical trial and they kick them out too. We've had a couple of them; they did not let them stay in the program, and so that told you that they were too bad, and they knew darn well it wasn't going to help them at all. So those two people were kicked out of clinical trials. The others, we're always seeing somebody's been in clinical trials if they're accepted. And then, of course, we're looking to see if they're playing golf every day. If they are, that one is not thick enough for us.
Yeah. You're looking at their lifestyle. People
yeah,
who are out playing
it's real
golf,
important.
They're probably one of those that may be, you know, living it up. And I know they're diagnosed with cancer and all, but we see on TV these images that are plastered all over the place about, you know, people who are, you know, 65, 70, you know, 80, whatever the case may be, and they're out, you know, playing golf. They're riding a bike through a field or they're playing basketball with their other retired friends. And, you know, they're really smiling and happy. And it's important to know that those are not the kinds of policies that you're bidding on at all because they go longer. It could be, you know, 15 or 20 years before a policy like that matures. And you're really going after these shorter returns, the higher return on investment, quicker turnarounds, and that's all part of the big picture, right? It's all about the quick turnaround.
That's right. And our people don't want those 7 to 10 year ones. You know, and a lot of people are buying those, and I don't understand it because you're not going to have cash flow for years to come. You know, if it's a 7 or a 10 year policy, I mean, they're old. obviously you're buying an old person, but they're not sick.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already went through that. We don't want to go through that ever again because we found out that they just linger and they linger and they linger.
Yeah, yeah. We've often said, you know, that somebody who is 95, 96, and they're healthy, they're probably going to outlive all of us combined.
That's what we're afraid of. We're afraid they're still going to be here when we're gone.
Yeah, which is great for them. You know, happy you're enjoying your life, happy you're still out moving around and living it up. But from an investment standpoint, that's just absolutely terrible, and that would be ridiculous.
Well, and I had a gentleman call me this week. And he said, do you have any policies on seniors? I said, I hope not. I said, you know. He said, well, I was interested in getting in a policy, you know, 80 or 90. I said, boy, you're talking to the wrong person. I said, we don't do them. I said, we've still got three that we don't have, you know, gone. They haven't ever matured. But I said, we're not ever buying another one.
Yeah, yeah.
But I found out there is people that buy senior policies. And I just can't imagine why in the world you'd do it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I'm like, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense from an investment standpoint to do that. So do you have any idea why they would do that?
I think maybe they're buying them for less.
Mm.
That's the only thing I could think of.
So they're getting a cheaper policy on the front end, but as far as the back end and it paying off, it just doesn't translate.
I know. I can't understand it. I'm waiting for someone to tell me when they finally get their money.
Okay. So it's important to stress that when people see these commercials where, you know, these elderly people are selling their policies, these are not the kind you're looking for. And so by bidding on and hopefully being awarded stage four cancer policies, what does that mean in the big picture for the investor? What's the advantage?
Well, that means that they've got some good policies, that we picked some good ones. We're going to get them in it and wait for maturities. And you know, they're going to have good maturities all along. That's what that means.
Okay.
The client is going to be happy. They're going to come in, you know, pretty near when they're supposed to. They may come in early. They may come on time. And then there'll be a few that are always going to be late. It's just, you know, some cancers act different than others. But most of them, in the last 3 or 4 years, have done just like they're supposed to. You know, they're coming in just like they're supposed to. We've got some older ones that are running late. But that's just part of it. You're going to have some that do that. And then you're going to have all these others that we've had in the last 12 months that were early. And the people were a lot sicker than we thought. The doctors didn't even know they were that sick.
Really?
So, you know, they died very early.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's, I guess that's, you know, from an investment standpoint, that's what you're going for. We all know the seriousness of stage four cancer. We know that it's very expensive. We know that in most cases, it's a deadly diagnosis. It's very, very, it's very serious. And so, you know, obviously, we want people to be able to beat cancer, but the numbers are there. They've been there for, you know, decades. And so we all know how stage four cancer is very serious. And so that's why these policies are available to bid on in the first place. This is where they come from, is they need that fast influx of cash to go ahead and go through the treatments, because it is very expensive to fight it, isn't it?
It is. It's $100,000 a month is about what it runs now. Because you're doing chemo every other day. You're doing everything in the world. And if you're at a big hospital, you know, they're doing all these things trying to save you, but it's very, very expensive. It's not cheap. And, of course, you know, we know some of those pills are $27,000 a month.
Wow.
I mean, when I think about that, I just can't believe they can charge $27,000 for cancer medication.
That's more than some cars cost.
And it is. And then a lot of people are going to research hospitals, and that is very expensive because the research hospitals are trying every new thing in the world, you know, trying to save lives. And therefore, it's very expensive if you go to a research hospital.
So how does the handoff work? When somebody, you know, well, let me back up just a minute. Where in the process does somebody usually decide, to go ahead and sell their policy? Is it they're on, you know, they're really, they think they're at the end of it, or is it at the beginning of like a fresh stage?
No, it's most of the people say, you know, I've got 12 months or 18 months, something like that, and then they get really serious. And they say, you know, I need to get some money in the house, and I want to get this done. And then we've had people that were too sick to sign their contracts. We had to wait till they come out of the hospital. And then we've got some that, you know, they decide to sell their policy earlier, you know, in the deal. And so they may come to us, you know, when they've still got 2 years. And some of them, it's at the first signs of it, because they've already planned out what they're going to try to do. And so then they may say, okay, let's get some money in the house now. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people, you know, they don't want to take everything they've got and then leave the wife with nothing.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to do that. So, you know, they want to get their policy sold, you know, where they do have money, and that they can do everything they need to do, and the wife will still have money.
And not saying the how the back end works, is there like a negotiation that goes on, or do you just say, here's how much we're going to pay, take it or leave it?
The negotiation is after we make the bid. I mean, after we make the bid, then we find out the other people bid it, and we find out if we get it, if we've bid high enough, or if we're too low.
And so how do you, and this is, I guess this kind of goes to like the profit margin and what makes it, so profitable for people. How do you find that sweet spot between, you know, hey, we want to, you know, outbid these other people, but still leave enough profit margin to make it a viable investment? How do you find that spot?
Well, what we know, first of all, is that we want our people to have 1% a month.
Which means?
Yeah. You know, they have to make 1% a month. So if it's a 24-month policy, they have to make 24%. If it's 18 months, you know, they have to make 18%. And then we also escrow premium for a certain length of time.
So for the handoff, how does that happen? When you bid on the policy, you find that spot, you've got it, and the broker say, okay, here, it's yours. What happens at that point? How does it transfer ownership from the policyholder to you or the bank or investors? Or how does that work?
Okay, then we say, okay, the broker, whoever the broker is, we say, okay, get all the policy transferred. They transfer it as the bank being the owner. And that way the bank is responsible for everything for us. So the bank, it comes over, it's in their name, and then when the people die, the money comes back to the bank again, then they put it in everybody's account. So they act as trustee on it. They are, in fact, the trustee on this account. And they represent us, and then they represent the clients. So the bank handles everything. And then before the bank gets it, then our broker, whoever it is getting it transferred over. So they're responsible for getting it transferred over, getting all documents signed. And then the lawyers are working on that to make sure we have good, clear title. And to make sure that the policy is paid, that there's not any lapse, that there's not any premiums that haven't been paid. So they have to verify all that with the carrier to be sure all the premiums are up to date.
My goodness, it sounds like there's a lot of, behind-the-scenes work that goes on, because, you know, we talk all the time about the actual policy and, you know, examining and really dissecting the policy, making sure you understand all of it, making sure it's going to be, profitable for investors. But I guess we've never really talked much about how much other, background work that goes on to make sure that everything's buttoned up, to make sure that it's a legit policy, to make sure that, you know, like you say, everything is up to date, everything is, you know, in order. I guess we never really talked about that much. I assume that takes a lot of time, doesn't it?
It does, because there is a checklist. A lot of people don't even know we do this. There's a long checklist, and they go down the checklist at their place and at our place and says, okay, did we get this, this, this? Is this signed? I sign a contract to buy the policy. Then I get the bill of sale. I mean, everything has to come over to us. I have to have the bill of sale. I have to have the contract signed. I have to have releases from the relatives. And then, of course, we have to have change of ownership. So there's about 10 documents we have to have, or we can't close on it. In other words, the owner's not going to get his money if we don't have all these documents in place.
And I guess that's the reason why this is so interesting is because, you know, people need to know that, yeah, we're talking about a lot of money here. We're talking about investments. We're talking about, you know, growing your wealth for retirement. And if you have these, you know, just like a willy-nilly type of situation, you know, it's about as reliable as the stock market, which we all know over the last couple of weeks could come and go in a heartbeat. So, you know, it's important to understand that this is a very buttoned-up process. It is a very executed process. It's a very thorough list of things that need to be done. So I think that goes to the reassurance to investors that, yeah, this is something, and this has been thought of. Everything has been taken care of. All the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. But what if somebody, and I don't know if anybody even asks this or not. They may not. I'm not sure. But what if, what about like beneficiary issues? Are there any, you know, when somebody comes and says, hey, so-and-so sold your policy, but I'm entitled to this and that and the other thing. Is that even a thing? Does it happen?
We've had it happen. We had an ex-wife that had been divorced 10 years, and the man died, and she comes and says, oh, I'm really the beneficiary. We said, it's been 10 years, lady. You can't possibly be beneficiary. He signed it over to us. And then we have to show him our papers and say, you know, we know that you need money, but that you're not going to get it here.
Yeah. So that's just a case of somebody just trying to, you know, I guess, con the system or something.
They're trying to con the system. In other words, the guy's been divorced 10 years. He has a new wife. This isn't going to work, folks.
Yeah. That's just,
I mean, that just doesn't work. But they will try it. I mean, you know. And, of course, all the heirs have to sign off when the person sells their policy saying, I know that I'm not getting anything out of this. I know that, you know, my father or my mother, whoever it is selling the policy to you. Wait, and that y'all will get the money.
I don't know that we've talked about that before, because we talk about how people sell their policy and you know, they make their own decisions and things like that. I guess I didn't realize that all of the beneficiaries listed have to sign off on the sale as well.
That's exactly right, because you don't want them to come back and say, I want that money. You know, they have to know in advance the mother or father has just cut them off of their life insurance policy. They're going to get other things sometimes. Sometimes they aren't. But they're sick, they need the money, and they have told the children, you know, I'm going to go ahead and sell my life insurance policy. And most kids say, whatever you need to do is fine with me. I don't need the money, or I shouldn't get it anyway. Now, that's most children. Some children, of course, are not that nice, you know.
There are some naughty children that want everything, and they're greedy.
They are greedy little devils. And they say, oh, don't sell your policy. I mean, they're really, really sick and need the treatment, and they're saying, oh, no, don't sell your policy. I need that. That's wrong. It's just completely wrong.
Wow.
So, yes, there's lots and lots of documentation when we do this. It's not just as simple as putting up your money and getting the policy. Behind the scenes, we're doing all this legal work to make sure everything is right before we give them the money. In other words, we're not going to give them the money till all the legal documents have been signed.
Do people ask about that? Is that a, because I don't think we've ever talked about it before. I didn't even know.
I don't think they do. They trust us that we're handling the legal, that we're going to put them in the policy. What people are shocked about, I think, is after we say you're in this policy, it may take us 2 weeks or 3 weeks to get them a signature ready for them to sign. Because there's so many, like lots of times, there may be 30 people in a policy. So we've got to do a type out, get all these done, and get each person a policy. And the policy is, you know, it's 100 pages. So we get it to them as quickly as possible. I know someone called the other day and said, "Hey, I don't have my policy yet." And I said, well, you know, we're getting them out as quick as possible. But lots of times we may have five policies we're working on, you know, getting all the documentation in and getting it out for signatures.
Wow. I'm thoroughly impressed. I know it takes a lot of work, but you're doing more work behind the scenes than I think most of us ever even had any idea about.
Well, we have to do all that or this wouldn't work.
Wow.
You know, we have to get all the legal done before we release the money. And so, people don't realize that.
So now that people kind of know a little bit about what's going on in the background, wow, that should make investors feel really, really even better than they did before, knowing how well buttoned up this is and how all the documentation is in place. I think, you know, there's never really been any question about that, but knowing all these other factors that we didn't even know just adds more layers of, I guess, confidence in the investment itself. That's very impressive what you're doing.
Well, now let me tell you another thing. The contracts that our clients sign, these are done by our SEC attorneys, and that's why they're 100 pages. You know, it protects them and us from everything known to man, and it covers everything in the world, you know, about the investment. So I think that's a good thing. Our contracts are very good, and they're good for the client. So that's another thing we do. You know, it's every piece of it is explained in the contract. And that page 14, which is now at the back of the contracts, didn't used to be, that is an important, important page because it tells you who the person is that we're investing in, how old they are, what kind of cancer they've got. It tells what the face amount of their policy is, how much we're investing, how much you're going to make, and it tells if it goes over what it's going to cost you. So everybody has to read that whole page, where they'll remember what I've told them and what they're investing in. That is an important page.
Wow. Wow. This is a very well-informed policy or type of investment. I know we've talked about how well-informed it is, but mostly our focus has been on, you know, the type of cancer and all those things we talked about earlier. But this is you've opened Pandora's box for investor confidence, I think. I think this just reassures people even more. We'll get into some of those risks and some of those things that will happen if the policy does go over. We'll get into that here in just a little bit. But for right now, this is Your Money with Faye Bagby, and your phone number is?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. And we're at 3105 Big Spring, right next to that big store, Ivy Cottage.
I think they should paint your name on the front of the building.
That's right. I mean, you know, we've been there with them so long, you know, you get to think that it is a big store. It's a small store, but it's a great store.
Yeah, yeah. I think over the years you've probably bought everything that's in there at least once, if not twice.
Oh, yeah, at least twice, maybe three or four times. I like to go in there.
All right, every Saturday morning around this time, we get into trivia, and you bring all kinds of interesting things to the table. Sometimes it's some history about something to do with Texas, or maybe a bucket list of a place to visit, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So what is the topic this morning?
I'm going to tell you about the smallest skyscraper in the world.
Really?
The smallest skyscraper in the world is in Wichita Falls, Texas.
Really? The smallest?
Would you believe that?
Skyscraper.
The smallest skyscraper in the world.
What does that actually mean?
Okay, let me explain. Back in the early 1900s, they had a large petroleum reserve in the city of Burke Burnett. You know, that's in Wichita County, right there by the. This is in 1912. And everything was booming. They were exploring all this. And by 1918, they had 20,000 people there. And they had a great oil field. The residents becoming wealthy overnight. So people were streaming to the local communities. Now, here we had the nearby city of Wichita Falls. So all these old people were saying, you know, we need some office space. Well, they had none. And they were doing stock transactions and mineral rights on street corners and in tents. That's all they had.
Wow.
Well, the nearby Newby McMahon building is a four-story brick building, and it's located near the railroad in downtown Wichita Falls. And it was built in 1906 by Augustus Newby. And he was with the oil firm of J.D. McMahon, a petroleum landman. Well, according to local legend, old McMahon announced in 1919, he said he was going to build a high-rise office building right next to the Newby building because all these wealthy men needed an office building. Well, everybody believed him. Everybody loved the idea. And so he said, okay, if you people will put up this money, and he raised $200,000. They said it'd be about $2 million today.
Oh, wow.
Now, the key to his swindle was, and his successful defense, by the way, and he was sued over this. And everybody said, well, look at this little thing. It's this little tall, narrow building. It's only four stories high.
Wow.
And very narrow, very narrow. Now, when he got it built, he didn't even put a stairway in it.
Really?
There's no stairway from the first to the fourth floor.
Well, now, how do you get to the fourth floor?
You had to use a ladder to get up there. Now, he showed them a blueprint, and he said, and they didn't catch it. He said the building will be 480 feet. Well, the proposed skyscraper depicted in his blueprints, you know, looked real big, you know, and of course it wasn't. And he used his own construction crews to build the building on this small, unusual piece of property next to the Newby building. He didn't even get a prior consent from the owner of the property.
Really?
He just built it.
Well, you can't just build a building.
I mean, he was a swindler from way back.
Wow.
And, of course, everybody sued because the building was so small. And they declared that it was a legally binding contract, a judge did. I mean, and they said, well, you should have looked at it to see how big this thing really was. I mean, it's just a little bitty narrow building. And the only thing people could use was that first floor. So a lot of people, you know, they had their little bitty desk and chairs in that little bitty first floor. Nobody was ever able to use this building. And it was featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Really?
Can you believe that?
Wow.
Yeah, it was even in Ripley's. And, of course, all during the 1920s, it only housed two little oil firms.
Really?
Yeah, because it was so small. They would board it up, it would get vacant, then somebody, you know, would say, okay, we're going to reopen this, we're going to try to do something. And in 29, in the Great Depression, office space was really inexpensive. And then a fire gutted it. Everything happened to that building. But I can tell you the building is still there today. People are still wondering about that little tiny building, you know, that was built. They even put windows in it back then. That's what's so funny. I mean, it is just a little bit wider than a double door. A little bit wider than a double door.
Oh, wow.
The interior of it is 12 feet by 9 feet. It's 108 foot on each floor. Can you believe this?
We have storage units available that are bigger than that.
That's right. And, you know, he put red brick on it and did all that, you know. But it's 40 foot tall.
And did you say a fire gutted the inside?
Yeah, a fire gutted it years ago, but it's still standing. They've always wanted to tear it down. And, of course, on one side now there's nothing. And that makes it really stand out how small this thing is. But it... you know, 108 feet. And the old guy didn't go to jail because nobody checked what he really said in his little drawings.
Yeah.
You know, he told them. You know, it wasn't going to be but 4 stories high.
The judge punished the people that tried to sue him. You said he told them they should have read it.
They said, you should have read the blueprints. Said, you know, he didn't tell you it's going to be big. And, you know, 108 foot on the inside. These people were so mad, you can imagine. They put and back in 1919, $200,000 was a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, they thought they had something, and they didn't. This old swindler left town, by the way. He never came back.
Yeah, I would have been run out of town, too.
That's right. I mean, when you sell something like that, and didn't even put stairs in it. That's what I loved. I mean, you couldn't even get from the first floor to the fourth. There was no stairs. Had to use a ladder.
Oh, that's
funny. Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
But anyway, Ripley's picked it up and said, you know, can you believe this?
And it's still there, you said, right?
It is still there. They've tried to tear it down. The city fathers didn't want them to do it, I guess, because it's a part of their history, what the guy did to them. And this was a railroad man that did it to them. I mean, you know?
See, he took his money and ran.
He did. And they called him a confidence man and fraudster.
That's some serious business back then.
It was. I mean, you know, he saw a good opportunity to make some money, and he just did it, you know. And it was such an embarrassment to the city and all the residents, you know. And they wanted to get rid of it after it happened, but no, they just kept it. Over the years, and so everybody still talks about it, about the confidence man and what he did to him.
So the legend has been passed down from generation to generation, and they leave it there as a reminder.
That's right, a reminder of the confidence man that came and got their $200,000 and left them that little tiny building and still probably laughing if he's still alive.
Is he still alive?
I don't know, but this was in, he came there in 1919,
yeah, he'd be
so he'd be pretty old by now.
Yeah, he's probably long gone, but still.
That's right. I mean, he got his money and got out of town and left him that little 108-foot building on each floor. I mean, it's hilarious.
I'd love to. Have you, you've never been there before, have you?
No, but I've got pictures. Yeah, I have a picture of it. Yep.
What is this called again? Because I want to go see this.
Okay, it's the Newby McMahon Building in the historical section of Wichita Falls.
Well, I feel a road trip coming out in the next couple of weeks.
I think it'd be a good thing to see. Everybody, the world's littlest skyscraper. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, boy. This is Your Money with Faye Bagby. Your phone number is?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. And we're at 3105 Big Spring.
You know, I just thought you could expand even more and open up shop in that building.
There you could. I mean, I just don't know. You'd have to have a small desk and everything to survive in there. But, you know, in the early 20s, two different firms officed in that small, small space.
I can't imagine two firms fitting in there.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh,
and, of course, back then when things were booming, everybody's looking for office space.
Yeah.
And this old boy said, man, I can handle that. Said, give me all your money, I'm going to build you a skyscraper. And none of them ever checked the dimensions of that thing. They didn't even look to see. They just saw it looked real tall and pretty. And, boy, they went for that.
Yeah. I wonder if you tried to pull the same thing in another city far away before, because, you know, back then you didn't have social media, you didn't have internet, communication was like the like Pony Express, and so it may have taken a while before the word caught up. I wonder if he tried it anywhere else.
I bet he did it again because it was so easy. I mean, if you can get $200,000 for that little building in 1900, you know, he could go and do it two or three more times.
Yeah.
And use the same set of plans.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one set would fit, you know, anybody. You just throw it to him and build another little building like that and keep going.
He'd have to eventually move to Europe.
That's right. He probably did have to leave a lot of towns. Because people were catching on what he was doing. But, but I thought it was so funny. Can you imagine when they finished it and looked at it and saw what he'd done?
Probably saw that thing and said, "You little whippersnapper."
That's right. And the judge said, "You don't have a case." Said he actually built a building.
He did what he said he was going to do.
That's right. He told you he's going to build you a little small skyscraper. And here it is. It's just a little smaller than what you thought.
Oh, wow. We should point out also your website is AmericanFinancialMidland.com and people can get a wealth of information from there.
Yes.
We should all take a field trip to this little skyscraper. I can't get it off my mind.
Yeah, it is pretty hilarious. And it's right there in Wichita Falls in the historical district.
All right. Let's talk about the risks of the investment. Because you had mentioned right before trivia that if people are prepared, or they need to be prepared. They will be prepared because over the life of their investment, tenure, people will have policies that go over. People will have to address that. And so that's one of the things that you talk to people about going in. That's one of the three big risks involved with a life settlement.
That's right. Your biggest risk in this investment is your policy could go over. And lots of times they do. And you have to always be prepared for it to go over. It could go over a year. It could go over 2 years or more. So we don't know. I mean, sometimes doctors can be wrong. And they might have missed something. Or maybe your body did something we don't know about. So it could go over. That's your biggest risk. The second risk is it is not liquid when it's invested, of course. When you buy into a policy, you put your cash in with everyone else, and you're in a life insurance policy. So that's the second risk. The third risk, which is no risk really at all, is if a life insurance company ever went broke, it would take longer to get your money. We've never had one go broke in Texas. In fact, I don't know of any that's went broke in years because someone would buy them because of the premium income. Insurance companies have more income than anybody in the banks because the premium is just piling in there all the time. And they're not paying interest on that. Remember that. When you pay your premiums, they're not giving you interest on that money. So they're getting interest on millions and millions of dollars every day.
And you've said before that these life insurance companies, they are required to have enough cash on hand that if every single policy they had came due at the same exact time, they could pay them all out right away, right?
That's right. And so if there was 1,000 policies matured today, they've got the money. They have to put up reserves, and I don't remember. I'll have to look that up again, what the reserve is on each policy. But they have to have up reserves on every policy. And then when you take the reserves and then the income, the interest that they get on those policies, they could pay any kind of a claim, mm-hmm. you know, because they have so much money on hand.
You know, we sit here and I'm just listening to you describe the three big risks, and it's almost like, well, where's the other shoe? When's it going to drop? There's got to be, you know, some kind of something, because even though we call these three things the biggest risks, it doesn't even seem like they're all that risky. It's not anything that it seems like investors should even really worry about, right?
Well, the thing is, always make sure that your premium is not real high. As long as your premium is not high, you don't have a risk. In other words, we try, and it's not always been that way, but we try to make sure the premium is never over 3%. And we've got some old policies that they were over 3%, and we didn't realize it. But we never anymore, we never put you in a policy if it's over 3%.
And when you set this up at the beginning, when you get investors, you know, into a policy for, you know, right at the beginning when it becomes available, you already take this into consideration. So, and I don't know what the right terminology here is. So I'm sorry if I, you know, butcher the description, but you have something set up so that in many cases, if a policy does go over, people aren't having to run down and write a check. You just take it out of their account or something.
That's right. Usually they have enough money in their account to pay it. And it can be $300. It might be $500 a quarter. You know, I've got some little ones that are $17 and $47. But then we've got some that are a lot more. And, you know, and you might have to pay that for a year or 2 years. But it's always manageable.
So, and this is always kind of exciting to hear some actual numbers to kind of put this back into perspective. Excuse me. When you say, let's just run a random hypothetical case here. Say you've got an investment of $100,000. Say it's an 18-month policy, so 1% a month. That means the profit is $18,000. What would a typical, and I know, like you said, it changes. There's a wide range, you know, from $47, you know, maybe a couple hundred, maybe a thousand or two. I don't know. But, you know, how much would that affect somebody's profit if they did have to pay premiums?
Okay. Let's say it was $500. So if you had to pay $500 a year for 2 years, that's $1,000. But let's say it was higher than that. Let's say it was $500 a quarter. That's $2,000. Okay? So if it was $2,000 and it went an extra year, it's going to take $2,000 off your profit.
So from an $18,000 profit on this example, $2,000 off for premiums, the investor still walks away with a profit of $16,000 for practically doing nothing.
That's right. And usually it's not going to be that much. I tried, as I said, to make sure it's not over 3%.
Okay.
And so that way it's very manageable and it's not going to hurt your bottom line.
So that's another consideration that you're factoring in when you even consider bidding on policies, is what is that threshold there with the, you know, is it below 3%? You know, how does that cut into profit margin? So I think people can rest assured that when they hear this, you know, and they say, wow, man, the policy goes over, I've got to pay all these premiums and blah, 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 and this is going to wipe out my investment. Clearly, that's not the case at all. There is still huge profit margins involved with the life settlement.
When we're buying a policy, the first thing we look at is, what are the premiums? Are they going to go up? Are they going to stay the same? Because you have to know all that. We looked at one this week, and right now the premium is very, very low. But it said in 2 years it was going to go up. Well, if it's going to go up a huge amount in 2 years, we can't buy it. That's why the guy's trying to sell it. Not only has he got incurable cancer, but he knows the policy is going to go up so much he can't even afford it.
So you're not playing that game.
That's a big consideration.
It's not a matter of, gosh, if the policy matures, you know, in time, then we can do all this. We can have all this this profit. But if it doesn't, well, you know, we'll just kind of take. You're not gambling that way. You're taking the safe road, which is what makes this such a conservative type of investment, right?
We are trying to be very conservative. And then, in addition to that, we try to escrow 6 to 12 months premium in case it does go over where it won't cost him anything. So we try to, usually we do 12 months premium. Sometimes it's only 6, but most of the time it's 12 months extra premium.
Okay. All right, so still, huge profit margins with this, but this is not a type of investment for just anybody. How would you describe a typical investor? So if people are listening and they're saying, wow, I'm really interested in this, I wonder if this is good for me, and people have to answer that on their own. But typically speaking, how would you describe a typical investor in a life insurance policy?
Well, they must be accredited. We cannot do someone that doesn't make at least $200,000 a year, or they have to be worth $1 million without their home. Because with this type of investment, if it goes over, we don't want someone that says, oh, I can't pay that premium. They have to be able to handle their business. So we know that if they're accredited, if it goes over, it won't bother them. We'll just take it out of their account. They have extra money. It's not their last dollar. People who are not accredited, it might be their last dollar. So we want them to be accredited. We want them to have extra money. We want them to have emergency money. Our clients always have emergency money. They're not on their last dollar. When they put money with us, they have money at two or three other places also. So they may have $1 million with us. They may have $300,000 with us. But they have money for emergencies, for premium, for anything that could go wrong.
So they're diversified in all aspects.
Oh, yeah, they're very diversified. And we want them to be accredited.
Okay. All right.
Our attorneys do, too.
So for the person who maybe isn't accredited, or maybe they're running through, you know, all their assets right now, and they're saying, I'm probably not going to make it, but I still want to do something. What would you advise to somebody in that situation?
Well, annuities are a wonderful, wonderful thing. I hear pros and cons on annuities all the time, and there should never be anything but good things to say about annuities. Annuities are a fixed instrument, okay? Your principal is safe always, and if you don't want to be, you want to be in the stock market, but you don't want the risk. An annuity is a good place because they have market returns without the risk. Mm. You know, they do the S&P, they do the Dow, they do all this inside an annuity, so you don't have the risk of the stock market, but you have great returns.
Okay,
and if the market goes up, you get paid. If the market falls, you don't lose a dime.
So
that's the good thing about an annuity.
People should understand that even if they're not accredited, even if they can't do the life settlement, it's still not a reason to give up on retirement. It's not a reason to give up on, you know, growing your wealth. You still need to move forward with it, but there are other options, and you can discuss that when people come see you. So
that's right, and you have to have $100,000. It doesn't matter which investment. It's a minimum of $100,000.
Okay, I'm glad you threw that in because I didn't even ask, and that's a good point right there.
It's an important point because we have people call that have $10,000, you know, and want to invest, and you know you just can't do it.
Yeah. All right. And you can discuss all the ins and outs, and people can come by and get information. If they want to get started, that's fine. Wherever they are in the process, they need to at least get started, and that all starts by coming to talk to you. So one last time, Fay, what is your phone number so people can call, make an appointment, come talk to you, and get started?
Okay, it's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330.